For the week of July 22nd, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 155, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Gill.
And I guess, Michael, maybe we should just get right to it today because we've got a lot to talk about, especially given what happened in Colorado last week. And so on today's show, we will, of course, be discussing the tragedy in Aurora, Colorado, where a gunman opened fire in a sold-out theater during the midnight showing of Dark Knight Rises. You probably know all the details already, so we'll be discussing more the industry reaction to the shooting. On a cheerier note, although not for broadcast networks necessarily, the Emmy nominations were announced last week for the year's Best Television Achievements. There's a huge catfight going on between Deadline Hollywood's Nikki Fink and author Bret Easton Ellis that has Hollywood buzzing. During Big Deal or Big Whoop, as always, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. And, of course, we always turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office. And, of course, this weekend was a little interesting.
Well, right. Actually, just like Hollywood, we're not going to start with the box office. We'll start with the tragedy in Colorado because Hollywood, when trying to figure out what to do, said, well, let's not talk about the box office over the weekend. They thought, you know, the tragedy happened Friday at midnight. And they said on Saturday to start talking about the Friday grosses and Sunday to talk about Saturday and holds and drops just seemed, you know, grossly insensitive to what was going on. So people like us who are used to getting hourly and daily updates on the weekend box office, and we're looking to see what might have been one of the biggest films of all time and still could be.
We look like a bunch of heroin addicts, effectively.
Right, right. We were going to our websites like Box Office Profits and Box Office Mojo and Variety and Hollywood Reporter, and they're all saying, yeah, we're not going to talk about it till Monday.
Right. And, so, and I mean, if you really wanted to, and this is why all of those newspaper stories were saying, studio insiders believe. Well, it wasn't Studio Insiders necessarily. In part, it was RentTrack who was collecting the grosses, and they do that electronically. So it's automated, and it's not like some person, you know, the computers don't know that there has been this horrific event that has happened in Colorado where they shouldn't go out and collect the grosses and then report them on their website.
Right. So that was one of the reactions that Hollywood as a whole had. I mean, it wasn't just Warner Brothers. None of the other studios talked about any of their movies. And in fact, if you look in North America, obviously The Dark Knight Rises had pre-sold a lot of tickets. Clearly, a lot of people still went to the movies, but they clearly took a hit, 10, 20, 30 million. We'll never know how many millions of dollars were lost on opening weekend because people said, yeah, I don't feel like going to a movie. But one way to measure that is to look at all the other movies. And if you look at all the other films, now that we have the box office grosses, the hits that every other movie took at the box office and the charts, films were dropping 50, 60, 70%. Clearly, people were not going to the movies as much this weekend. Still, of course, they sold over $200 million worth of tickets for the top 10 movies. Clearly, it set one of the biggest opening weekends of all time for Dark Knight Rises. But Spider-Man, Ice Age, every other movie, you can see that people who were sort of thinking, do I want to go to the movie? I don't really feel like it.
Yeah, you know, and we should say, just, you know, for to kind of get the prerequisites out of the way. Of course, we know what happened. Most people know what happened over the past 7 days. And that is on Thursday night, there was a midnight screening as Dark Knight Rises opened in North America in Aurora, Colorado. A gunman walked into the theater and started shooting, killing 12 people. And as you say here in the show notes, dozens were injured.
Including somebody with a baby.
Yes, which
And many people have had debates about this. So what were you doing with a baby at a midnight screening? And other friends say, I've had a baby. I've been nursing. And they'll sleep through the whole thing. Even a noisy movie, they'll be fine. You don't have to tiptoe around a baby. I have had long debates about people, whether for not talking about the issue of this particular movie, but just having a child at a late night screening. And a lot of people were saying, well, so what?
Yeah. I mean, you know what? At the end of the day, I always say with children and including my own, set yourself up for success. And if your baby starts crying at, you know, midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning during a loud action film, you have nobody to blame but yourself. Because
that's true. And please exit the theater quickly.
Right. And you know what? It's kind of like, what are you doing? But the 6-year-old up at midnight? I mean,
yeah, that's a little more dicey. But thank goodness that the little baby was not injured, as far as I know, certainly not fatally.
The 6-year-old was killed.
Yes, but very sad. But again, is it irresponsible to have a child at a midnight screening? I don't know. It depends on the parent and the child and the world. I wouldn't, but you know, I'm not going to second guess that because of what happened here. It's just a question of in general.
Yeah, no, look, I mean, certainly there are Mommy and Me screenings at many theaters that take place usually during the week on like a Monday or Tuesday in the middle of the afternoon, and they set up and basically you can bring your screaming baby or infant. I think going to a midnight screening on opening night for a much anticipated film with an infant, which or a newborn, which you can't really control what goes on there, it's just not setting yourself up for success.
Well, I would just say that the worst thing that should have happened is that the six-year-old child should have been grumpy the next day because they didn't get enough sleep.
That would have been
the only person responsible for the tragedy is the killer, not the families who brought their children.
Right, and we are purposefully not saying the killer's name.
Well, I hadn't purposed. I just hadn't bothered. Some of the other things that happened, the studios did. There was a Paris premiere that was canceled.
So Warner Brothers canceled the Paris premiere, and I guess they also canceled one in Mexico and a couple of other countries.
Right, and the stars stopped giving interviews promoting the movie, and they released statements, of course, of sympathy and support for the families. Warner Brothers has pledged to make a substantial donation to the victims' families. Theater owners around the country are setting up ways to raise money for victims. One of the people injured or killed was a comedian, and that there's been money raised for them.
Which I think are all smart things. I mean, this, and as you know, Michael...
Well, just human things, not smart, but just, you know...
Yeah, and this is a Warner Brothers, and I'm going to say Warner Brothers here only because they released the film. It's their worst nightmare. They have a movie they spent $350 million on at a minimum, and that is with marketing. And here, this one person devastates the lives of at least 12 people, ends those lives, devastates dozens, if not hundreds or thousands of other lives, and... When you think
they feel like schmucks for worrying and thinking about a franchise, but which employs, you know, that's a major corporation that employs a lot of people. And this was going to be a $1 billion property, probably still will be worldwide. But, you know, you feel like a schmuck. But, you know, a lot of people make a living off of, you know, big movies and making them and releasing them and showing them in theaters and putting them out on DVD.
Right. And that's exactly where I was headed with that. If you wanted to talk about a ripple effect or a stone in the lake kind of ripple effect, Warner Brothers is at the edge of the lake on this one, and yet they're also in the center. And it's just, it's their worst nightmare. And
it's not even a nightmare because you don't even think about something like this, despite a history of, you know, there have been problems at movie theaters in the past.
Yeah, I mean, usually with movies like Boys in the Hood or Colors or Godfather 3 had a shooting at it.
Well, that was the trend in the late 80s, early 90s, people saying, oh my gosh, you can't have movies, you know, talking about gangs or violence or you know, urban life, meaning black people, because it'll attract violence. That sort of has faded away for the past 20 years. You've had problems at X-Men: The Last Stand.
Right.
The Curious Case of Benjamin Button even had a shooting at it. The person wasn't killed, but they were shot in the arm. I think if there's a shooting at The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, that puts to rest the idea that the movie itself is responsible. You know, that is a movie that would not provoke violence in anyone. So clearly, it's just something that will happen. You have millions of people going to the theater every weekend. Once in a while, you're going to have some sad tragedy or you know, violent action because millions of people are going to the movies. So millions of people who do anything, whether it's going to a sporting event or a film or something like that, you know, something like this is going to happen every once in a while. My favorite reaction was from a young British man here in New York City where, you know, they were showing, obviously, all the steps that were taken. A lot of theaters had cops out front of their theaters. The screening I went to at the Ziegfeld, there were two cops out in front of the theater. It didn't make me feel safer because I didn't think it was necessary. I didn't feel unsafe going to the movie. But that's what they did. Some theaters asked people not to wear masks or any costume at all. A very few places, like there was a science center that was showing an IMAX screening of it, and they said, please don't bring backpacks. You know, reasonable steps to take for this weekend. But should that be what you do forever? And this young British man was asked in front of the Lincoln Square in the Upper West Side of Manhattan. He was asked by New York One, well, do you think there should be tighter security at movie theaters? Which, of course, is ridiculous. You shouldn't be patted down every time you want to go see a movie. And this man burst out laughing and said, of course not. You need better gun control laws.
Yeah, well, that's really, I mean, we're not going to get political here, but I've been shocked watching some of the news broadcasts where people say, this really isn't the time to talk about gun control. And I'm thinking, well,
John Stewart beat you to the punch on that one, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's precisely, which is why I didn't bring it up. But I mean, I just find it, well, when should we be talking about better gun control? You know, I think maybe after the third mass shooting in Colorado, not after the second.
Well, you know, after a heart attack, you should discuss a diet. And it's perfectly reasonable to discuss that, though this show really isn't the format for that. But
I completely agree. And, you know, I thought Christopher Nolan's statement was very poignant. And he was saying that, like, for him, the movie theater is his home. And for somebody to come in and violate that, it's unfathomable. And I was reading probably one of the better pieces I read was by Jeff Gonick, and I hope I'm pronouncing that name right, Gonick or Gonick, who was writing in Paste Magazine's website. And if you don't mind, I'd like to read what he wrote.
Please.
He writes here, like everyone else, I woke up to the horrific news coming out of Colorado. I started by thinking about the families, their loss, their terror, the questions that are flooding their heads, the answers they won't find. Then I thought about the story itself. A lone gunman entered a theater and set off a tear gas grenade and opened fire during a midnight screening of what should be one of the few collective cultural events of the summer, on par with the Olympics. He preyed on not simply their vulnerability, but their disbelief. He hijacked their imaginations, using them to keep the audience in their seats when the shooting began. He used the wonder of the movie going against them. He took something that brings us together and used it to push us apart. He tried to steal our ability to share this experience. And I thought that was a brilliantly well-written paragraph.
I found it interesting. There hasn't been a lot of discussion of the usual trope of movie violence begets real-life violence, or do movies encourage violence? It's certainly a very grim, violent film, The Dark Knight Rises. But that hasn't been much of a discussion so far. And it's interesting because the guy apparently had his hair dyed red and told the police he was the Joker, or perhaps announced he was the Joker. I don't know if this is actually a rumor.
No. I mean, you saw him yesterday when...
Well, I saw him with his dyed red hair, but I'm not sure if he declared himself the Joker.
Okay.
The one time I heard it was a quote from the New York police chief, and how the heck would he know? You know, because the police in Colorado have essentially not discussed much of anything. So I'm not sure how that detail came out. I guess it's true. We saw his hair was dyed red. But I like how the reporter, they made the point of saying, traditionally, the Joker has dyed green hair. So, of course, that means this guy isn't even a good fan.
Yeah, he's completely insane. He's not...
Right.
Yeah.
Right, he's not even a good fan. The worst headline, I thought, came in the Hollywood Reporter. Like everybody, they had a ton of coverage every possible way, essentially, you know, keeping people up to date on the news. They tried to strike the right tone. This one, I thought, was a bit much. It said, saddened but undaunted, moviegoers line up for The Dark Knight Rises.
Well, you know, I actually went out to dinner on Friday night, and literally a restaurant in my neighborhood that is usually packed and you have to wait an hour to get a table, walked in, there were two people sitting down. And I turned to the waiters and the host, and I said, the hostess, I said, hey, where is everybody? And they said, you know what? We're wondering the same thing. We can't figure it out. They said, maybe it's because The Dark Knight opened. We don't know, but this is completely unusual. And I don't know whether it was, you know, The Dark Knight Rises or whether it was the shooting, but business was definitely off, not only at movie theaters.
Hmm. Well, I just thought they made it sound like the Blitz in London during World War II. You know, people are going to a movie. They're not, you know, movie going has not become dangerous suddenly. So, you know, I just thought the headline was a bit pitched a little high.
Well, how did box office do throughout the world this weekend?
All right. One last thing. Are there any issues that were raised with security or stuff? I mean, I know the guy basically that I think the idea is he went, you know, came in regularly and then propped open an exit door and brought back in weapons that way. So that doesn't seem like a security breach you can do much about.
No, I mean, certainly there are
people have snuck into movie theaters since time began, you know, to avoid paying tickets.
Yeah. I mean, and there's been discussions, you know, kind of closed door discussions with trade groups and theater owners about why didn't the alarm go off when that door was opened, and making sure that the alarms go off. And for me personally, I was listening to the police chatter going back and forth during the event, and I just kept hearing this one police officer saying, how do we turn off the movie in Theater 9? How do we get the lights up? And he kept saying it seemed like for about 5 minutes. And, you know, that's a digital theater. That film was being projected via digital cinema, and there should be ways to immediately stop all movies on all screens and bring up the house lights in the event of an emergency. Forget about
like
a shooting.
Like a fire.
Correct.
Or something.
Yes. Yeah. And yet, you know, for 5 minutes, this person is saying that. Now, in the days of 35mm film, you'd have to have a projectionist go up to the booth, turn off the film projector and move up the lights. But in the days of digital cinema, you can do that from outside the theater on your iPhone, but you really can't because there's no software to do that. But somebody sitting 500, 600, 1,000 miles away could have shut that movie off via network and made the house lights go up. But, you know, so
maybe that's one lesson that can be learned.
Yeah,
that can apply to lots of things, not just this particular unusual tragedy.
I completely agree. But, you know, the reality is, who's the projectionist right now? Where was the projectionist? And when you try and answer that question, you realize there was no projectionist.
Because these movies are one or two employees running every film in the multiplex, right?
Well, right. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there was a projectionist or a projection tech, but I highly doubt it.
And there's no evidence yet that anything was delayed as far as medical care or safety or people getting out. It was, at most, we know right now, it was a distraction, perhaps, but we don't know that that was an issue in any way, shape, or form.
Correct.
As far
yes.
as getting people out of other theaters.
And my advice to the police officer would have been, listen, unless you can turn off the movie and raise the house lights immediately, leave the movie running because it's your only light.
Good point. Well, obviously, we'll discuss worldwide box office. It took us till this morning to get the information. Because of the blackout that the studios did on the box office over the weekend. So it's Tuesday morning, and we're just getting the information now. The number one movie around the world was, of course, The Dark Knight Rises. It grossed $249 million worldwide. It opened in a number of countries, not massively all over the world. It grossed $88 million overseas. So that's obviously a strong opening. It was the number one movie in the rest of the world. It grossed about $250 million worldwide. It had the second biggest midnight screening of all time. It had the largest opening weekend for a 2D film. That means not, 3D. It clearly is poised for big things, and we'll have to see how the box office works for it down the road. I'll be surprised if it doesn't gross $1 billion worldwide when all is said and done. And number two around the world is Ice Age Continental Drift. That goes to another $79 million. It's at $529 million and counting. And number three around the world, The Amazing Spider-Man, which grossed $39 million worldwide. It's at $613 million and counting. And number four, the Pixar film Brave, that grossed another $26 million worldwide. It has $279 million in its treasure chest so far. It has a long campaign ahead of it. At number five is Ted, the foul-mouthed teddy bear movie. That grossed $14 million. It's at $220 million and counting. And number six is Umizaru 4, a Japanese film about coast guards who risk their lives to save civilians. That grossed $7 million, and it's at $35 million and counting. I imagine if we'd gotten better information from Japan, that would have been up on our list last week or the week before, because it clearly opened bigger than $7 million a week or two ago. At number seven is Madagascar 3. That grossed $6 million. It's at $489 million. And number eight is Magic Mike, which just passed $100 million worldwide. And number nine is Snow White and the Huntsman, another $4 million for that. That's at $380 million. And number 10 is Savages, the Oliver Stone film, which grossed another $3 million, basically in North America. That's at $40 million. And tied with it, basically, is Pokemon the movie 2012, which grossed $3 million worldwide. That's at $13 million and counting. And other box office news, Katy Perry, Part of Me, is now officially the fourth highest grossing concert film of all time in North America and possibly the world. It's grossed $26 million worldwide. $22 million of that is in the U.S., behind only Justin Bieber, Michael Jackson, and Miley Cyrus. So that's a wildly successful concert film.
Well, do you think that, and just going back to The Dark Knight Rises, I mean, we're doing worldwide box office grosses here. The Dark Knight Rises only opened in 17 international territories, 18 if you count North America. So only 18 territories throughout the world. In the U.S., it opened on 4,400 locations, but worldwide, it opened on 330 IMAX-branded screens, which is a record. So I agree with you. I think Dark Knight will surpass $1 billion, this particular film. And I think that IMAX may have helped it, but not having 3D certainly lost it a few dollars, as did the running time. I think it's over 2 hours, so you get one less showing per day.
Well, I question that because, I mean, I look at AMC 25, which is a massive multiplex here in Manhattan, and as demand grew, they kept adding screening times. There were 55 screenings of the movie in one day at that one theater. It was every 20 minutes or 10 or 15 minutes all day long from 9 in the morning till 2 in the morning. So I don't see how that is that the running time is a factor at all when you can do stuff like that.
Well, when you have 25 screens, you can do stuff like that.
Well, but multiplexes are the way of the world. And you see that all the time. You go to a theater, and if demand keeps going, they say, well, guess what? We're going to knock Moonrise Kingdom down a few screenings today and add another screen for, you know, The Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah, I mean, there's issues with that because, of course, there's no virtual print fee, so the theater will not be paid for that particular that screen. You have to book each screen, meaning that if you plan on showing it and book it on five screens, okay, you will get five virtual print fees will go to the theater. But if you then decide to run The Dark Knight Rises on, let's say, 10 screens, you'll still get only five virtual print fees, which means the equipment isn't being paid for on that additional five screens. But that's very technical and very geeky and very.
But don't they work with the studios when demand is huge and they all want it to be seen on as many screens as possible? Don't they work together to solve whatever technical issues come up to make sure that whatever's best for the movie in the studio and the theater is done?
Well, it's not really a technical issue. Maybe I shouldn't say that. It's more of a business issue.
Right. And, I mean, don't they all work together when a movie like this comes out? I assume they're not doing it on the sly.
No. They're doing it, I mean, because there are logs and records that of what the servers and projectors played, so they're definitely not doing it on the sly, but that's the way the VPFs are written. You have to book the screen, and so, you know, it's understood that you decide to, quote-unquote, interlock a film or do a virtual interlock. That has to be written in the contract, or you have to go back and renegotiate, but usually you just don't get a VPF for that week for that screen.
And what does that mean?
Meaning, you know, let's say each VPF is $800 for the run, and they can break that down by week. So if that week you were supposed to get, let's say, $300 for use of the screen that week from the studio, well, then the studio just won't pay it. So Moonrise Kingdom, in your example, would not pay. So in the case, I think it's, what, 20th Century Fox is that film, Moonrise Kingdom?
I'm not sure.
Well, whoever released Moonrise Kingdom would not pay the studio, well, would not pay the theater, in this case the AMC 25, for use of that screen for that week.
That's Focus. Focus is that.
Focus,
all right,
yeah, okay.
But they say we can make more money by booking this other movie, and therefore we'll take that hit.
That's right. That's precisely correct.
After 20 tickets sold, we're going to be making money.
That's right. That's exactly what that. And believe it or not, a company like AMC does do those calculations.
Absolutely. So we geeked out last week. If you come to our show notes, you can get a list of every single large format theater in the world, IMAX and the couple other brands that are still out there. And you can find out which ones are genuine IMAX, which means that they're actually a seven story tall screen. And there are very few in North America. In all of North America, there were only 62 screens showing The Dark Knight in genuine IMAX.
So a seven story tall.
That's right. And 11 of those were non-traditional locations like aquariums and zoos and science centers. So there were 51 commercial venues showing The Dark Knight Rises in genuine IMAX. And that's places like the one screen in Manhattan, Lincoln Square, which is the only one that's genuine IMAX. All the rest are just glorified regular movie theaters. So if you want to check out your state and your city and see if you have a genuine IMAX screen, come to our show notes, click on the link, check out the list and see what's going on. And you can do that no matter where you are in the world. There are two links, one for the North America and another one for the world. There are only five genuine IMAX screens in the UK. There are only two or maybe three in all of Australia, one in New Zealand. So, you know, check it out and find out, because unless it's a genuine IMAX screen, you should not be paying a premium to see a movie there.
So what you're saying is that out of there's 98 genuine IMAX screens in the rest of the world, outside of North America. Well, no, outside of the United States, because there's 98 genuine IMAX screens rest of world, including Canada. So what you're saying is that most of these 330 screens that The Dark Knight Rises opened on were what I like to call FIMAX, what some people call LIMAX, but they were IMAX Digital, as IMAX calls it.
Yeah, they're not gigantic screens. You're not seeing the film the way Christopher Nolan shot it and wants it to be seen in IMAX. You're getting stuff cut off on the sides or the top and the bottom. So it's not genuine IMAX, and you shouldn't be paying $19 or any sort of premium to see it that way. In my mind, every movie should have good picture and sound. So that's all those branded IMAX theaters are offering. It's like the THX logo in the old days from George Lucas. He was saying, hey, these theaters have kept up their picture and their sound, their top quality. But I wasn't paying extra to see a movie in THX. I was just happy to go to that theater and give them my business because I knew I could trust that they'd have good picture and sound. If IMAX wants to use their brand to say, hey, this theater meets our standards of high quality, you know, presentation of film, great, but don't charge me a premium for it.
Well, just to wrap up here on The Dark Knight and Rises, and you know, just, again, what a and yes, it's horrible that 12 people were, it's horrible that this happened at all, but what a nightmare. Again, I understand it's not a nightmare, but it's a devastating blow to Warner Brothers. Do you think in the end The Dark Knight Rises will be nominated for Best Picture? Because you know, if you look
because of this.
Well, I don't think because of this. I mean, as a film.
It's not going to be nominated for Best Picture, but not because of the tragedy, just because it's not a good enough film. None of the other two were nominated. This one will certainly not be nominated now that I've seen it. There's no question in my mind.
Okay. Well, I mean, you look at Lord of the Rings, and were all three films nominated for Best Picture?
Absolutely.
They were all nominated?
That's right.
Okay. So, and of course, it was only the third film that won.
That's right. It swept the awards and one of the great sweeps of all time. So, yes, I do not believe that Dark Knight will be nominated based on the quality of the film and the type of film it is. That certainly doesn't help. It got good reviews. It didn't get great reviews. You know, there were some mixed reviews in there, as there should have been. Frankly, the villain's dialogue was incomprehensible. You could not understand what Bane was saying for half the film. That's a problem. I don't understand how it could happen. But, you know, what movies will be nominated for Best Picture? Not The Dark Knight Rises, but why wait and see the movies? I can tell you now that the nominees for Best Picture will come from this crop. Argo, the film directed by Ben Affleck, which is going to be playing at the Toronto Film Festival. Cloud Atlas, which is by the Wachowski siblings, as well as Tom Tykwer. Flight, the Robert Zemeckis film. The Hobbit. Hyde Park on Hudson, which has Bill Murray playing FDR. Life of Pi, the Ang Lee film based on the best-selling novel. Love, the film that Sperling saw at Cannes about an elderly couple facing death. Les Miserables, the film adaptation of the massively popular Broadway musical. And The Master, directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, a film about cult. People will take it as being about Scientology, but it's technically just about a cult. Looking at the films coming out this year and the options that are out there, I don't think there's many movies that have come out so far that are possibilities. Maybe Moonrise Kingdom, maybe Beasts of the Southern Wild, though that seems highly unlikely. But I think, you know, those are the films that are going to be up for the Best Picture. We'll have to see what they're like, how they do with critics. But I don't think there's anything that's come out this year. I don't think The Avengers is a possibility. And I don't think there are many other major or small films that will be contenders. So I think check out the list and see how I do at the end of the year.
Yeah, I mean, I think films like Beasts of the Southern Wild, which was the Sundance winner and was also in Cannes.
Still doing well.
I think, you know, it may get an acting nod, a writing nod. Moonrise Kingdom may get a writing nod. I think The Great Gatsby may get a cinematography nod. I don't know. I think we'll have to wait and see whether it can contend for Best Picture. Life of Pi, Ang Lee's film, is supposed to be, I mean, it looks fantastic. So I've seen about 5, 10, 15 minutes worth of footage, and it just looks beautiful. Whether the story holds together and whether it holds together over a 2-hour movie, we'll see. But I'll be very interested to see at the end of the year how well you fare here on picking these. But of course, the Oscars will only be held in February, March of next year. And the Emmys for television, well, they're going to be held in September. So that's going to be coming up first.
That's right. The Cable Ace Awards were announced last week.
Whoa, I'm sorry, Michael. It's the Emmy nominations, so it's not Cable Ace Awards
cable
at all.
Awards, the awards ceremony for cable programming, isn't it?
Yes, but of course the Emmys is for all television programming, and the Cable Ace are, as you say, just for cable. So in no way was this the Cable Ace Award nominations. It was definitely the Emmy nominations, as I understand it.
So major network shows were, in fact, eligible to win awards?
Apparently they were, yes. Yes, now that you mention it, I think they were.
It was a bad year for the major networks. The Cable Ace Awards were awards created because cable channels felt like they couldn't get an Emmy nomination. And so for years, they had their own awards show. And then eventually, they started winning enough enemies. They had enemies. They absolutely did, the major networks. They also won Emmys and finally dropped the Cable Ace Awards and said, well, there's no need anymore. We feel like we're at the table. We get recognition. We get attention. Our shows are being acknowledged. Now it's gone so far, the major networks may have to create their own new awards show to make sure they get nominated because there were no dramas nominated from the major networks. They all came from cable. Half of the sitcom nominees came from cable, and frankly, more should have.
Well, wait a second. Wasn't The Good Wife nominated for a drama?
No, not this year. It was last year.
Okay.
The year before, Juliana Margulies was nominated again for Best Actress, but every single drama nominee came from cable, and they are, in fact, Boardwalk Empire from HBO, Breaking Bad on AMC, the best show on television, Homeland on Showtime. I'm looking forward to checking that out on DVD this week. Downton Abbey on PBS, which switched from the miniseries category to drama where it belongs. Game of Thrones on HBO. And Mad Men, of course, on AMC. So those six dramas all came from cable.
And I should point out that we're talking about the Emmy nominations, and I always struggle with how much we should cover American television because, you know, it is
the world.
Yeah, but as many of our international listeners have told me, it is broadcast all over the world. So these are being lauded in America and in the United States, but these shows are seen everywhere.
That's right. And of course, Downton Abbey comes from the UK. It would be nice to see more and more shows coming from the rest of the world to America and getting nominations, like Luther, that has been nominated in the miniseries category, another UK show. So you're seeing more and more shows, international shows coming to America, being seen on cable and getting recognition. The Hour, a pretty good miniseries, got some nominations.
I was actually, when Downton Abbey was nominated as a drama instead of a miniseries, I kind of thought of you and went, wow, okay, there you go. Michael's got to be happy.
It's not so clear-cut. I tease and I mock the Emmys, but Downton Abbey was last season or the season before listed as a miniseries. This year it's up for Best Drama, and that's where it belongs. On the other hand, American Horror Story, a show on the...
I want to say AMC, or is
it... No, no, no. It is... Is it AMC?
Or is it FX?
I think it's FX, actually.
Okay.
It's not AMC. And this is from the creator of Glee and Nip Tuck. This show was put in the miniseries category. And you say, well, wait a second. It's already been renewed for a second season. But in fact, without giving anything away from the first season, we found out that the whole season is self-contained and that the second season will be a brand new show. Some cast members will be back on the show, but they'll be playing different roles. It's a new setting, a new story, a new event that will happen and be beginning, middle, and end for that season. So each season is self-contained, somewhat like 24, but more radically. It's literally a different show with a different horror story being told. Jessica Lange will still be on the show, but she plays an entirely new character. So you go, well, okay, now that is sort of in another world. It sounds like it's an anthology series, is how the creator Ryan Murphy describes it. And it's not the same show, so maybe it does belong in the miniseries category. These things aren't easy to figure out, but sometimes they are. Like, you look at Luther and Sherlock. Well, Sherlock Holmes is in the miniseries and movie category. It has 3 2-hour TV movies in the season. Well, what is that? Is that a series? Is that a TV movie? What is it? I don't know. It's not as easy as it seems. Downton Abbey, I feel, was a clear mistake. But a lot of times in the new world we live in, where shows are weird hybrids of things, it's not always straightforward as to where they belong.
Well, and if we would just read our own show notes, we would find out that American Horror Story is from FX. So,
right. It's hard to remember some of these things. American Idol didn't get nominated in the Best Reality Show. On the other hand, Jeff Probst didn't get nominated as the host of Survivor, even though he's won virtually every year that this category has been around. So maybe Ryan Seacrest will finally get some love, or perhaps Kat Dealey, or maybe Phil Keegan of The Amazing Race, because his show wins Best Reality Show again and again and again, but he never gets any love.
Well, I guess it didn't win last year.
That's right. Finally, it got pushed aside.
Right. Well, maybe the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, maybe they were worried that Jeff Probst didn't have any more room on his mantle for all of the Emmys that he's won.
That's right. The cruel part of American Idol not getting nominated was that The Voice was their big competition. I guess they should be happy. At least it wasn't The X Factor with Simon Cowell. You know, and of course, everybody wants to talk about the snubs of the Emmys. What shows got snubbed? What shows didn't get nominations but should have? What shows did and didn't deserve it? Some people describe Glee as being snubbed. And I think that's ridiculous because the show had such a fall off in creativity that I'm glad the show in its third season did not get a lot of Emmy love. It didn't deserve it. It got a shocking one Emmy nomination for the actress Dot Marie Jones, who plays Coach Beast. And that is it. And you're looking at a show that had, you know, in the tens of nominations last year and the year before. So that's really a fall from grace.
Well, and there's no, I guess, goodbye Emmy nominations for folks like Hugh Laurie from House or Kira Sedgwick from The Closer.
That's right. And again, House had outstayed its welcome. I think it's appropriate. I mean, normally Emmy would just say, oh, we have to give you a nomination because, you know, you've been a beloved show, you've been around. But, you know, it's perhaps a sign of a little maturity or growth. What do you think about the fact that there are 6 nominees for comedy and 6 nominees for drama?
I think it's fine.
Expanded that category. Yeah?
Yeah, I think it's fine because, I mean, you know, one of them's the throwaway, right? Like, one of them is just not going to win. Well, actually, no. In drama, they're all great dramas. But, you know, and in comedy, hey, you know what? If there are six great shows out there that should be mentioned or highlighted, even if you know not all of them can win or that one is head and shoulders above the rest, so be it. At least it's getting some publicity.
Well, I don't think it should be a publicity thing. It should be just these are the best shows of the year. But I think that sort of sneaking expansion to six nominees, which has happened in the last few years, not regularly, and now it seems to be sort of, you know, a given, is a recognition that there are so many more shows being made. I mean, there are so many channels, and they all have sitcoms, they all have dramas. The pool of shows to choose from is so big now that I think keeping it to five is just becomes a little absurd. In fact, you might even see seven nominees. I mean, I don't think they should go to 10 necessarily anytime soon, but five nominees is a little limiting when you have, you know, literally a ton of shows out there. And frankly, you know, shows that weren't nominated for Best Drama, The Walking Dead, Southland, Sons of Anarchy, Justified. I mean, those are all dramas that would have been very respectable on that list. And of course, what I say is, if you name a show and say, oh, I think The Walking Dead should have been nominated, you are obliged to say what show should not be on the list because you have to make room for it. In my case, I would have taken off Mad Men because it was its worst season by a mile, as far as I'm concerned. And that just should not have been on there.
Well, if it wins, it'll be the fifth best drama award for that particular show, which would tie it with what, I guess, Frasier won five. And I think there's a number of that have won four times, if I'm not mistaken. And most of them, well, some of them are sitcoms, but Hill Street Blues comes to mind.
Yeah, Hill Street Blues won it four times, L.A. Law, The West Wing, those are the dramas, and Cheers and All in the Family also won it four times. So Frasier's the only show to win the top award, meaning best drama or best comedy, five times. And they did it five times in a row. And that could be what happens here with Mad Men. I don't think it deserves it. I don't think it should get it, but we'll have to see. Emmy has a hard time, you know, once they fall in love with you, they're locked for life.
They're married. Well, you know, I thought it was interesting. John Cryer, who was always a supporting character on Two and a Half Men, he decided to submit himself, and the network decided to submit him for Best Lead. And he was nominated Best Lead Actor.
And Ashton Kutcher was not.
Yes, well, and Ashton Kutcher took over for Charlie Sheen in that show, and he was not nominated. But neither was Kelsey Grammer for Boss, so, which is a completely different show, I understand. I switched gears there, but I thought he might get a nod.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he's had Emmy love before, so that always makes you more likely to get it again. And the show had terrific press. So that's another drama that could have been up for Best Drama, frankly, given the critical reviews. I think it was a real changing of the guard in the variety series category. This is sort of the talk show, comedy show.
This is like late night kind of stuff.
It's sort of right. Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, of course, were nominated again. Also, the two Jimmys, Jimmy Kimmel and Jimmy Fallon, who wasn't nominated, David Letterman, Jay Leno, Craig Ferguson, Conan O'Brien. I mean, that's a real...
Well, it tells you who people are watching. I mean, Craig Ferguson, you can almost say, look, I'm sorry, but you're just on way too late at night. I don't watch you. You know, I actually like Craig Ferguson. I know some people don't, but I can understand why people don't like him. I think he's just like, he's very real.
He's doing very well commercially. And it's DVR, baby. DVR the show. I love Craig Ferguson. I think he's the best interviewer on late night television right now. But The Daily Show, of course, is the 800-pound gorilla. It's going for its 10th consecutive win in this category, which is astonishing.
And you know, just not to beat the Craig Ferguson horse to death here, but you were absolutely right. When Madeleine Albright was on his show a year or two ago, they compared tattoos. And I thought, how interesting that Madeleine Albright, you know, would talk about such a thing, but that she has one. And that Craig Ferguson on television got her to speak about it.
So overall, I would say that the Emmy nominations were pretty good. There weren't a lot of groaners. There were still knee-jerk nominations, but there's a good mix of shows in here. You know, Homeland got a lot of love. American Horror Story got a lot of love. Game of Thrones and Breaking Bad are, you know, have been receiving nominations. But, you know, Michael C. Hall got nominated for Dexter. At least the show didn't get nominated again. But you know, there's a lot of fresh blood in a lot of categories here. And I think it's healthy.
Well, speaking of fresh blood, none of the vampire shows got nominated.
That's true. True Blood has never gotten a lot of love from the Emmys. And the more sexy and out there it's gotten, the less likely it was to get a nomination, I think. I think that's one reason Sons of Anarchy doesn't get nominated. It's sort of an edgier, out there show. And that's not always what Emmy likes.
Well, right. And I really only went down that road so that I could somehow take your fresh blood comment and allude it to vampire shows. That, you know, that was the only reason I said that. But ultimately, I mean, do you think any of this really matters? Is it a big deal that some of these shows were nominated or not nominated?
A big deal to them.
Well, then I guess it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, huge shakeup here at News Corp or Fox. Rupert Murdoch resigned from a string of boards last week, but the media mogul is really not stepping aside. His move is described by News Corp as house cleaning, as they plan to split the empire into two distinct units, and we've talked about that before. Perhaps more telling was the elevation of fast-rising News Corp exec Peter Rice. He's gone from Fox Searchlight to chairman of the entertainment division of Fox Network Groups to chairman and CEO of the entire Fox Networks group, meaning Rice has added the all-important and very lucrative sports channels to his portfolio. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, big deal to Peter Rice. I don't have an impression of him as an executive, so I don't know what he brings to the table or what sort of guy he is. So I don't know whether it's a good or a bad thing about him. I don't know if you have a...
I have a personal knowledge. I mean, I've worked with him in the past, and he is one of the nicest people I have ever dealt with in Hollywood. He is, and I've known him since he was a creative executive. And of course, now in the most recent years, it's kind of a little bit harder to know, you know, how he's been since he's kind of at a level where he no longer deals with me on a regular basis. But he was always incredibly nice, incredibly smart. And everybody in Hollywood liked him, knew how smart he was, and would go out of their way to help him. And when he was moved from Fox Searchlight in the film division over to television, of course, it was seen as a sign of, okay, we're grooming you, Mr. Rice, to become more of a leader here at Fox and kind of a second, third, fourth in command kind of role. And everybody thought, well, it's a shame for Fox Searchlight. It's a shame for the film industry, but we're really happy for Peter Rice.
Well, if he's that nice, how is he succeeding?
I have no idea.
Well, that's maybe good news for Fox. They certainly have a lot of problems. The hacking scandal continues. Today, there were just criminal charges were announced against eight major figures in that scandal, including two major top former editors of Rupert Murdoch, including Rebecca Brooks and the prime minister's top communications guy. So that scandal has got a lot of legs. That's going to be going on for years to come.
Now, the prime minister's top communications guy, do we know who that is?
Yes, I just forget his name, and I didn't care. But
okay,
yeah, no, absolutely, no. He's like the spokesperson, like Obama's spokesperson that you would see dealing with the reporters every day. That's who he is. It's Andy Coulson is his name.
Okay,
and he's not anymore. He's former communications chief for Prime Minister David Cameron, and he's become a real, you know,
thorn in his side. That's for sure.
Yeah, thorn in his side. Anchor weighing him down. You name it. Pick your metaphor.
Well, and you know, I was only joking about I don't know how Peter Rice is getting ahead. I think he's getting ahead because A, he's smart, and B, he's incredibly nice, and people want to see him succeed. So
that doesn't sound like the recipe for success in Hollywood that I know.
No, backstabbing, though. That's a good
that's where it's at.
In any case, we joked that when Disney bought out Pixar, it was really Pixar taking over Disney. And maybe we got that wrong because Pixar has announced that they'll be filming a sequel to Finding Nemo, the latest Pixar film to get sequelized. So the people who used to mock others for churning out all those unnecessary sequels and straight-to-DVD knockoffs has now made three Toy Stories, two Cars, a direct-to-DVD car spinoff called Planes, a prequel to Monsters, Inc., which is called Monsters University, and now the very unlikely sequel to Finding Nemo. How does Nemo get lost again? And if he gets lost again, like, how do you punish him? That's my question. The big news was that Andrew Stanton is licking his wounds after John Carter, and guess what? Guess where he's going? He's returning back to animation. But the bigger news may be that Pixar is becoming like everyone else, really. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. You know, Finding Nemo, that's really, they've turned a corner here. Everybody knew the Cars sequel was just about money, no matter how they said, we want to get it right. We didn't do it right the first time. We want to get it right. It's such an important property for us. And we know it's made a lot of money, but we want to make it good. And then it turned out to be even more anonymous than the original. So it just felt like, wow, that's depressing. But now they're making sequels to everything. And it's sort of what made them special is sort of fading away a little bit.
I couldn't agree more.
A sequel to Finding Nemo. Brave is good. It's not great, but it's good. It's a respectable movie. But it's been a few movies since they've had a... We're so used to them, I guess. They're human. We're so used to them making one great movie after another, one original movie after another, one world-beating, wildly successful, Oscar-winning film, that for them to become human and just make good movies, we're sort of annoyed at them.
I couldn't agree more, first of all. And I would say that this has a lot to do with the fact that the creative heads are now executives, specifically Ed Catmull and John Lasseter, who are now running Disney. I think that much like any company, whether it's Microsoft or whether it's Kodak or whether even Apple, I'm sure someday we'll be saying this about, or IBM, you look at their reigns, and they usually last 10 to 30 years where they have like these mavericks and these really smart geniuses run them, and they're go-getters. And then most of the other people who are in the company, they're kind of they're happy with the status quo, and they don't want to change things, and they just kind of start retreading what they've already been successful at. And somebody else comes along and is far more proactive and innovative and takes the throne. It happened to Microsoft in the 2000s, and Microsoft did it to IBM. It happened to Kodak recently due to many reasons, but I think that's what happens in companies.
Well, it's bizarre. I mean, Toy Story wasn't a movie that had a natural sequel in it, and yet they made two great sequels to it. It's a great trilogy. And yet the one Pixar film that begs for a sequel is The Incredibles. The
I
one
know.
Movie where you're like, there's your, if there was ever a movie meant to have a sequel, The Incredibles is it. And yet that one they don't do.
Go well, because Brad Bird is no longer there. That might be part of it. Well, no, actually, isn't he? Well, I guess he did Mission Impossible 4.
I'm sure he, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess technically he's still there. When they do a sequel of Up or WALL-E, then we know they've really jumped the shark.
Exactly.
Now, speaking of jumping the shark, CBS is kicking it old school this fall. The newest edition of Survivor debuts on September 19th, but the rest of the network's shows all make their debut in the official premiere week of September 25th. It's true that shows debut all year long, of course, and networks are finally, albeit slowly, realizing how pointless it is to stuff their best offerings into the sweeps months of February, May, and November. But there's still a lot of advantages to debuting a clutch of new shows and returning favorites in a 12-day span. It focuses attention on your network, of course, cuts through the noise of the media, and encourages a lot of press attention and lets fans know, hey, CBS is debuting a bunch of new shows. Look at us. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. And for all the reasons you just enumerated, you know, from moving away from that to now saying, actually, you know, it's a really good idea. It works again. Now there's 500 channels. We need to make noise and draw attention to ourselves. This is a good way to do it. It focuses everybody, gets them going. And, you know, you still have to program year round, but the fall preview has its advantages.
Well, let's move on to publishing for a second, because classic novels are getting a spicy makeover thanks to erotic publisher Total eBound. The bound, by the way, might very well stand for bondage, since these titles will contain all the original text of classic works, but toss in 50 or more shades of naughtiness. You get what I was doing there, Michael?
I do.
Okay, just checking. And that's kind of a hidden Easter egg for our listeners from past episodes. Jane Eyre has, quote unquote, explosive sex. And I can't believe those words just came out of my mouth in a public forum. Well, she has explosive sex, there you go, twice, with Mr. Rochester. Catherine in Wuthering Heights indulges in bondage sessions with Heathcliff. And Holmes realizes he fancies Watson.
We knew that. That's a given.
The publisher says, we want to enhance the novels by adding the quote-unquote missing scenes for readers to enjoy. People are going to either love it or hate it.
Hate it.
But we're 100% convinced that there's a market there.
No, there isn't.
As for the Bronte sisters, Charlotte Bronte was a bold, forward-thinking lady for her time. There's so much sexual tension and eroticism there. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop. This is 50 Shades of Stupidity.
Oh, and there's our title.
I mean, seriously, I hate the whole Sense and Sensibility and Sea Monsters and Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter and taking all these old books and throwing in zombies or whatever. It's like, oh my God, you know. But at least those were written out and they were new stories. This is literally taking the text of Wuthering Heights and inserting sex scenes. I mean, that is so idiotic. It boggles the mind. I mean, every bondage novel is getting optioned for a movie. Authors are getting snapped up by publishers, and they're trying to recreate the Shades of Grey phenomenon. And it is a phenomenon. They're selling millions of copies. But this is just as idiotic as it gets. Anybody who loves these novels will be furiously annoyed at you. Anybody who hasn't read these novels or doesn't like them, the idea that they would start with this version because, well, I'm going to get a little sex in there, it's just ridiculous. So, bad idea.
Well, let's stick with publishing for a second. The Department of Justice is taking two publishers to court, but made a deal with two more that forced them to adopt the Amazon publishing model. Now, of course, we've talked about this whole antitrust suit in the past. The Department of Justice opened the deal for comments and were flooded with nearly 1,000 formal replies to their antitrust lawsuit, many of them from groups representing thousands, if not tens of thousands of people. On Monday, the Department of Justice dismissed all the complaints and comments, saying they came from people in the publishing industry who have a vested interest in the way things have been done in the past. It said their concerns were more about e-publishing in general and the changes it is causing in the industry rather than the DOJ deal. On the other hand, the 80 or so comments that agreed with them were apparently spot on. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I thought this was a big deal. It was kind of shocking. They didn't just dismiss them. They sort of mocked them and said, oh, give me a break. You people are just scared. You don't understand your own industry. You don't know what you're talking about. And you all have a vested interest in the way things are. Well, we're talking about comments from like independent bookstores, major chains, large publishing houses, small publishing houses, librarians, authors, best-selling authors, and small authors. Basically, people who never agree on anything. They all have competing interests going at one another for various reasons on every issue that comes up in the industry. Large publishers, small publishers, big bookstore chains, small chains, authors. They're all at loggerheads all the time. And they all came together and said, you don't know what you're talking about, and this is not a good deal for the industry, and you need to rethink what you're doing. And they basically dismissed seeing all these competing interests who came together remarkably and said, we're very, very concerned about this. Not only did they ignore them, they mocked them when they did it. It was kind of shocking.
Yeah, I mean, some of the comments that the DOJ had, okay, I could see their point on some of them, but not all of them. I mean,
sure.
Yeah, I mean, I was like, okay, I get that. They're right there. But then some of them, you're thinking, okay, you really don't understand the industry in which you are making this decision in.
Yeah, they said, quote, charges of predatory pricing by Amazon lacked any persuasive evidence, end quote. Now, I don't know what the legal definition is of predatory pricing, but if you're selling something and a company buys it wholesale and sells it for less than they paid for it repeatedly, losing money on every single sale, that sure sounds like something that might concern you.
Well, I mean, and look at what Google's doing with the Nexus 7 and you know, all of these, you know, and Amazon is doing with the Kindle Fire where they sell
right,
it for less.
But if you want to sell your own product at a loss for various reasons, that's fine. But when you're selling someone else's product at a loss, you're buying their ebook for $13 or $14 and selling it for $10 and taking a $3 or $4 loss, which drives other people out of the business and gives you massive market share. That sounds like predatory pricing to me. But again, I'm interpreting that term in, you know, a standard understanding of what those words mean, not the legal definition. It's certainly a practice that is upsetting and concerning and could destabilize your industry. We saw what it did to the music industry. So whether or not it constitutes legal predatory pricing, it's certainly something that should upset and anger and concern publishers and authors with very good reason.
Well, let's flip back to television for a second. You see what I did there, Michael?
Flip.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Well, it works for both publishing and television. Anyway, here's why, Michael, you need two DVRs. Sunday night at 10 p.m. is chock full of well-reviewed quality dramas. All of these drama shows are airing at the same time, so let's go over them. AMC's Breaking Bad, which opened to its highest numbers ever at 2.9 million viewers. USA's Political Animals, starring Sigourney Weaver, with 2.6 million viewers. HBO's The Newsroom with 1.9 million viewers, and finally, the winner of the night, A&E's Longmire with 4.4 million viewers, more than the show reached in its debut 7 episodes earlier. None of these figures include viewers who watched reruns or on-demand or DVR'd copies 3 or more days later. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a very big deal. This is why there are 6 nominees for Best Drama. I mean, that's a lot of television to watch, and you do need 2 DVRs. I can only tape 2 shows at a time, so what happens is I tape 2 shows, and then I have to find a rerun of another 1 or 2 to try and catch them later. It's pretty impressive, and you see that a lot on television in prime time all over the place. There's a lot of good television on right now.
You know, TiVo sent me this promo email saying, hey, you need to buy a Premiere TiVo so that you can record four channels at once for the Olympics. You don't want to miss any of it. And I thought to myself, four channels at once? I mean, I can't even catch up on American Horror Story. I mean,
I haven't watched that yet either.
I haven't seen the end of Lost, which is still on my DVR. So I don't need four channels at once. That would just suck more time out of my life.
But and Breaking Bad got that record ratings despite the fact that they were not available on DirecTV.
That's true, and that's where I was headed. I was gonna say if I had the ability to record four different stations at once, record Viacom through DirecTV now, because Viacom and DirecTV, they've ended their battle, and the 17 plus channels, I think it's 26 with HD, of all of that programming is back on the satellite network and their DirecTV service, allowing streaming on tablets, smartphones, and everything else like that. No mention of the terms included, but DirecTV made a big point of saying it wouldn't have to carry the premium movie channel Epix, and defiantly blaming Viacom for the whole thing. Said one DirecTV exec in a statement, and this is a quote, "The attention surrounding this unnecessary and ill-advised blackout by Viacom has accomplished one key thing. It serves notice to all media companies that bullying TV providers and their customers with blackouts won't get them a better deal." Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big snap is what that is. Wow.
Yeah, except here's the thing. Viacom got a better deal. So there you have it. I mean,
What are the terms? How do you know?
Apparently, they got 20%. They were looking for a 30% bump. They got a 20% bump. So they did get a better deal. Of course, Epix, they don't have to carry Epix. Okay, so on DirecTV, you don't have to carry Epix. Everywhere else, maybe you do. Maybe they turn Epix into a premium channel. Who knows?
Well, there you go. All right.
Sticking with television for just a moment, Jennifer Lopez said she was 99% certain she wouldn't be returning to American Idol, but you can make that 100% sure since J-Lo, Idol announced that pop star Mariah Carey is joining the show as a judge. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's turning into a big whoop. Now it seems like they're just going to be rotating judges in every year. So it'll be some other big celebrity this year and then another one or two next year. They've talked about just making it a revolving door so they can get attention every year because they never know the kids they're going to have. At least they can get attention and audiences by bringing in celebs and let you see, gee, I wonder what, Moby will be like on Idol. Not that Moby would ever do Idol. Well, but whoever it might be, I guess those are their draws now. It's the judges rather than the contestants.
Well, when a show begins booking celebrities to play guest roles, that's usually, it's called stunt casting, and it's usually when a show is going downhill and they need to either bump up the ratings for a sweeps week or a sweeps month or just in general. And they're doing stunt judge casting at this point.
Right. It's the second biggest show on television, but it is on the downslope. And you're right. They've said now, we don't want stability. We're 12 seasons in. We got to keep it fresh. Like, oh, yeah, well, if you had three great people on your panel and they work great together and the network and the numbers were great, you'd want to keep them on there for 5 years.
Now, is the Randy Jackson going to still be there?
Oh, absolutely, because he's a manager or he's got a major connection with Mariah Carey. So absolutely. He probably got a piece of the deal for bringing her onto the show.
Oh, good point. We probably should have put this story up in the slot here next to our Pixar story because DreamWorks Animation is feeling its oats. The standalone company is distributed by Paramount right now, but is in talks with Sony and Fox about who might handle future releases. Meanwhile, they've just purchased a library of properties called Classic Media for a reported $155 million and redubbed it DreamWorks Classics. Now, if Classics Media sounds familiar, it's because the library of titles include Lassie, Casper, The Friendly Ghost, The Lone Ranger, George of the Jungle, Rocky and Bullwinkle, my favorite, VeggieTales, Fat Albert, Where's Waldo, and a whole lot more. Some of these are licensed out, of course, with Disney making a Lone Ranger movie and DreamWorks itself already doing a Sherman and Mr. Peabody movie from Rocky and Bullwinkle. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. It's a smart grab. I wonder who else was competing for it. I think there were like six studios. I'm surprised Disney didn't step in and try and win it. Maybe they did and they just thought the price was too high, but it sounds like a reasonable price for a pretty valuable library. But Sperling, VeggieTales? You love Christian-themed vegetable fairy tales?
I'll be honest. I didn't really know what VeggieTales was until about 3 or 4 seconds ago when you told me what it was, but I just thought the name was funny. So that was my way of, throwing a joke into the middle of our news story.
Okay.
But, we should probably move on to Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. I'm not sure that this week's story will really affect some of our listeners, but it does have everyone in Hollywood buzzing. And I just have avoided this story like the plague. And it's Nikki Fink, who is the founder and editor-in-chief of Deadline, which is a trade website that has taken on Variety and The Hollywood Reporter. So it reports trade, entertainment industry news. And Bret Easton Ellis, author of Less Than Zero, American Psycho, and other books. And I guess also a screenwriter and now filmmaker in his own right. What is going on here, Michael? They're having a little bit of a fight.
Did he direct a film?
I think he's raising money through Kickstarter to direct a film. Maybe I'm wrong about that. I could be wrong.
Well, it started with Twitter. And as we all know, Twitter is the, you know, the danger for celebs. Don't use Twitter while driving. Don't use Twitter while being a celebrity.
I think that celebrities should not use Twitter while breathing. That's my...
That's what our friend...
Karen Woodward said. Yeah, she says that all the time.
So what happened was Bret Easton Ellis apparently put out a tweet saying that he and Nikki Fink now share the same West Hollywood apartment building. He didn't say where or what it was. He didn't give his address out, obviously. He's not an idiot. But he just said something like how annoying that he now shares a building with Nikki Fink. He wasn't happy about it, obviously. That was the undertone of it. Well, she went ballistic, reportedly. She just went nuts. And she called up ICM. And according to Ellis and people at ICM, she was screaming at them and yelling at them, demanding to speak to his agent. You know, those are the people that represent him for some of his business dealings. And he tweeted again about this and said that she threatened to destroy him and his agents. And then she went ballistic-er. So what happens is now Ellis says that Nikki Fink threatened to reveal home addresses and other details of ICM employees, demanded an assistant be fired. Apparently the first person that she spoke to who wouldn't put her through or didn't satisfy her demands. She demanded that they sever ties with Bret Easton Ellis, demanded personal contact info about Ellis, I guess, meaning his phone number and email or whatever.
They live in the same apartment building, for Pete's sake. She could just stake it out.
She might want to have posted it online, or who knows what she wanted to do with that. And then he says she also contacted people in their building, like the management and other neighbors, and made similar litigious threats. Like, yikes. So there is truth to this, obviously. ICM hired some top lawyers. I guess they had people on retainer, but they reached out, hired some top lawyers to deal with this.
So you basically have the editor-in-chief of a trade publication who upset with an author for revealing that they live in close proximity to one another.
And what neighborhood they live in, I guess.
Yeah. And look, I got to be honest. When I lived in New York in the early 90s, I lived in an apartment building. Guess who my neighbor was? Bret Easton Ellis. No. Yes. Oh. Yeah. So, I mean, it's not
did
like...
you tell people about it?
I told everyone. I had billboards. I had a radio campaign. I had bus stop advertisement. No, I could care less. I mean, and, you know, and who cares where Bret Easton Ellis lives?
Right. Well, here's the thing. He did not reveal their location. People don't know where he lives, presumably. It's not public knowledge. I'm very sensitive about celebrities having their homes revealed to them. I find it annoying and upsetting and obnoxious. TMZ does this all the time. When Katie Holmes moved to New York City, they're showing the outside of the building. I mean, I know it's public knowledge. They followed her there. They know she lives there, whatever the building was. But like the show, I don't know that, you know, celebrities get weird, creepy people all the time. I wouldn't want my location revealed. I wouldn't want my address revealed. Most people wouldn't. And I completely empathize with that. But
look, my neighbor up until 2008 was Christopher Nolan, and he knew that everybody in the neighborhood was not going to tell, was not going to publicize the fact that he lived where he lived.
Well, because he just trusted them to be normal, decent people.
Right, exactly.
Right. And that's not what Bret Easton Ellis did. He didn't say. I mean, he gave the neighborhood, I guess. It'd be like saying Katie Holmes moved to Chelsea or Katie Holmes moved to whatever. I suppose you could then stalk that 30-block neighborhood and try and find her. But that's not the same as saying, here is the building where she lives at. Here's the photo of it. Here's video of us standing outside showing her walking in the door. That crosses a big line.
Yeah, and a couple points here. One, you could stake out a 30-block radius in Los Angeles and see any number of celebrities, which Nikki Fink is not a celebrity. But she has created a number of enemies, and in my opinion, throughout this industry. And there are a lot of people who do not necessarily want,
she doesn't feel for her safety. Do you think she gets threats and weird stuff like celebrities do?
Who knows? Who knows? Yeah. And you know what?
She deserves her privacy.
She deserves her privacy, but you know, at the same time, I guess if you really are concerned for your safety, why is that? And could it be because of some of the things you've written that may or may not be true?
No. I mean, she doesn't jeopardize her privacy and her safety. because of something she wrote about a movie deal or something.
Yeah, well, I would hope not. But
right, I'm saying that doesn't mean you're fair game. Like, it's her fault.
No. That's not what I'm. That's really
what you were saying. You're saying because of the stuff she writes, she's more concerned about people attacking her and being unhappy with her. Yes, that might make her enemies or make people unhappy with her, but that doesn't mean she should have to receive any sort of threats of any sort. But the
issue is... Well, what I meant to say is what you just said.
Oh, okay. I felt you were going down the wrong road. But the point is, he didn't do that. The tweet did not say where she lives. So she had no reason to go ballistic. Now, I hope that ICM... I mean, and if it's true what she did, telling them they have to fire him, threatening to reveal their personal information, demanding his personal information, demanding assistants be fired. They're going after Brady Sinelis' livelihood. They're going after ICM's livelihood and their personal safety and issues. Nobody wants their personal... You know, you do want Nikki Fink presumably going online and saying, here are the bastards at ICM who won't do what I want, make their lives hell, and posting their phone numbers or emails or addresses? No, that's nightmarish. And I hope they go after her and actually don't just bat her down and make her step back, but actually, you know, take it farther and sue her if there is actionable reason to sue.
Well, another issue that is made itself known here is that, you know, everybody always says, you know, bloggers, do they really follow journalistic standards? And certainly when it came to Nikki Fink and Deadline, there were always some issues about how is she getting some of those stories? Are they all true? There was always some question about the veracity and the sources. Those are questions that never arose with The Hollywood Reporter, or rarely arose with The Hollywood Reporter or Variety, the two kind of stalwarts of industry trade publications. And now one has to wonder, oh, gee, every time an ICM client gets a role, you don't write about it, or you're writing negative things about ICM agents, but not CAA agents, their competitors. So one has to begin to wonder about some of the things she's reporting because of this incident.
Well, if it's true, she's behaving unprofessionally, obviously.
Well, you said everything I just said, but how many words was that? Like 10, 12?
So that's a concern. I mean, you know, she's not going away. People like her aren't going to go away. They're always going to be the head of Hoppers and the Walter Winchells. You know, this isn't the end of Nikki Fink. It does show a certain leveling with Twitter. He said something, she fights back. He uses Twitter to bring the issue to the public attention. That's sort of interesting. You know, if you actually reveal someone's private address, I would find that upsetting. I don't like what TMZ does. You shouldn't watch TMZ. Do we care? No, maybe not, but it's kind of fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it is something that people in Hollywood are talking about, mainly because I think Schadenfreude means that we're all waiting, not we, Hollywood is waiting to see certain people get their comeuppance. One of them, in my opinion, is Nikki Fink.
If you behave unprofessionally, and there have been lots of stories, then people would like other people to know that you're behaving unprofessionally and not a person that you should respect. And perhaps that's what's coming out here. But there is some breaking news before we head into our closing section. Ghost is closing on Broadway. That's one email I got.
I never saw it.
Well, don't worry about it. The other thing is that modern...
That was a ghost joke. I never saw the ghost. Never mind. My jokes are flat today, I guess.
The other one is that Modern Family is in a little bit of a turmoil. They were scheduled to have their first table read for season 4, but they're in big contract negotiations with the cast, and those have fallen down. The cast has flatly rejected the studio's offer. They don't think it's anywhere near what they should get. Usually after season 3, this is when people renegotiate and say, hey, if you want us to stay with the show beyond season 7, you got to give us more money now and a lot more money later. And this is when you get your big payday, you know, if you agree to stay on a show beyond what your initial contract was. And this is where they're looking to cash in. I mean, this show is a big hit. It's a big hit for ABC. It's launched another show, a lot of other shows behind ABC. It's profitable for them. They've just scored a big cable deal. They've got syndication and DVD to look forward to. And it's selling very strongly all over the world. So when you hear cast members being offered, say, for seasons 4 and 5, they were offered $200,000 per episode.
Which is, you know, that's within reason.
Money. That's $4 million a year. That's a ton of money. That's anybody would be thrilled to make that. But hey, you're talking about a $500 billion, $800 million franchise worldwide. It's a lot of money at stake here. So they're just looking for their cut of that big pie. You know, why should it all stay with the studio? So don't think that they're being greedy. They're sort of saying, hey, this is going to make this big amount of money. We want our big amount of our cut. So their negotiations have broken down. It's not happening right now. We'll have to see what goes on. But right now, the table read has been canceled, and So they're stalling the beginning of filming season 4, which could affect its premiere in September.
Yes, that's really the ultimate, the end game there is it could affect the premiere. That's, yeah. Yeah.
Well, and yeah, but good God, no sitcom should go 8 or 9 seasons. None. No sitcom should ever run that long. It's not a good idea. Maybe The Simpsons because it was animated. Otherwise, not a good idea. You'll run out of ideas. It's just not a healthy creative thing.
What about South Park? South Park has been pretty good, you know, consistently. I mean, it's always had bad episodes in each season, but every once in a while, there's a really good episode.
Well, they film about 10 or 12 episodes a year,
oh,
as opposed
point.
To 22, which is a major studio. It's a different beast. Also, again, it's animated, and that raises different issues of longevity that you don't have with sitcoms. Not simply the factor of children growing up, but it's a very different beast when it's animated. They tend to be more satirical, more broad. They're a different beast than a situation comedy. Mary Tyler Moore is the best sitcom of all time. It went 7 seasons. It got better every season. It stopped and it was on top. There's no sitcom, MASH, All in the Family, Cheers, you name it. They went 8, 9, 10 seasons. Believe me, those last seasons were not necessary.
Well, and even Seinfeld, you know. I mean, Cosby Show is a classic example of a sitcom that lasted too long.
Well, it went from 1984 to 1992. So it lasted 8 seasons. That's a lot of seasons for any show. Really, 4 or 5 is where you should be calling it a day for a sitcom. It's very rare to go 6 or 7 seasons and not be tired, even if you have wholesale cast changes like you had on Cheers and MASH. But Cosby Show's went 8 years. That's a long, long time. Yes.
Well, if you agree with Michael and his 8-season sitcom rule, you could write to us. And you could write to us dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And that's exactly what CJ Flynn of dcinematools.com did. And you might recall we spoke about, I guess I went to see Spider-Man at a Regal Theater where the screening was going flip-flopping between 2D and 3D. And because of that, there was a silver screen that was at the front of the theater. And how that kind of tweaked the coloring. You remember we spoke about that?
I do. Let me read the email so that you can explain what the heck you two are talking about.
Okay.
I'm out of the geek loop here. This is from CJ Flynn of dcinematools.com.
Yes.
Here's what CJ writes. Since I just heard you talking about it, that all high gain screens are horrid, but silver screens are worse since it is near impossible to get the paint perfect, and they can't be cleaned at all, and they go dark faster than a matte screen and need to be replaced. Then CJ goes on to say, and it is aluminum, not silver, of course, and it's important for passive 3D, not because of the gain, but because it holds the alternating polarity of the spinning photon that the Z screen gives. I'm sure you know all this, referring specifically to Sperling, obviously, since I don't. I'm sure you know all this, but you forgot to say it, and it gives the wrong impression sometimes. The other thing is that I think that most of the Regals are outfitted with Sony systems, and most have 3D, except for the biggest rooms, which have Barco Doremi, since the Sonys can't go wide enough for the big screens.
And Barco is the projector, Doremi is the server, so yes.
All right.
He's absolutely correct.
What the heck are you two talking about?
Well, let's start with the Sony stuff first. Sony can light up a lovely 35-foot screen. So a 10-meter screen, 12-meter screen, maybe a 15-meter screen if you're really pushing it. You have a 60-foot screen, a 45-foot, well, maybe even a 45-foot screen can be lit by Sony. But any big screen has to be lit by another type of projector, one using Texas Instruments technology, the DLP chip. So that would be Barco, Christie, NEC makes a projector that does that.
So if you're in a multiplex and you're in the biggest theater in the house, it's not going to be a Sony projector. If you're in a smaller theater where they maybe seat 200 people, it's probably a small screen and it might be a Sony projector.
Correct. Yeah. And that's okay. Pretty much. And I can tell you this projector was a Sony projector. It does have that dual lens coming out the front of it. So your left eye, right eye. And, you know, Sony has 4K. So basically what they do for 3D is they have a top of the screen, bottom of the screen, or top of the frame, bottom of the frame image. The top is the left eye. The bottom is the right eye. And it shoots out of a beam splitter through two lenses.
What does that all mean?
Basically, you have two images that shoot out of two different lenses and are married on the screen again.
So you were at a Regal Cinema, but you weren't in the biggest screen in the house because they were using a Sony projector.
Well, I was at a Regal Cinema that didn't have a screen that needed a bigger projector.
Right. Okay. So that's why it wasn't some other version. So what else is he correcting up at the top when he says it's aluminum, not silver? What does that mean?
Well, meaning it's not really silver. It's not the, you know, a precious metal. It's aluminum that the screen is actually made out of aluminum. Aluminum rusts. Aluminum, and you can't clean it, so it gets dusty and dirty. Because there's a couple reasons, and I've been told varying things.
Is there a coating?
Yes. One, that you ruin the coating. Two, that you will get streaks.
So if people have what is commonly referred to as a silver screen, as opposed to what's the traditional one?
Usually a white matte, vinyl
so
type
if
screen.
If they do have a silver screen, there are other issues of not just the fact that the gains and all that stuff, but the fact that they can't keep it clean.
Yeah, and what he's saying here, the Z screen is this screen that goes in front of a lens for Real D, or I guess Master Image. It's not a Z screen, but it's a revolving disc. It has polarity. And so it, you know, basically one image is shifted, and I'm simplifying this. One image is shifted to the left, the eye. The other image is shifted to the right eye. The aluminum slash silver screen helps with that. By the way, it also adds a little bit more brightness.
So he's saying there are positives and negatives to the silver screen.
Correct. Yes. And most people believe the negatives far outweigh the positives.
And he just wanted to point out some of the positives to you. By the way, it's aluminum, not actually silver.
No, I think he's pointing out all the negatives. All of these are negatives.
They can't be cleaned. They go dark faster than a matte screen. Need to be replaced. But he says it is important for passive 3D.
Yes. And passive is, you know, when you don't have... expand is really the only active 3D, and Volfoni maybe. Most people are seeing their 3D in Real D, or they're seeing it in Master Image. Dolby would be passive, but it uses a waveform. It has nothing to do with that kind of polarity.
So in English, you and CJ would say if you were building a movie theater with a big screen, you would not want to use silver. You would not want to lose the what's known as the silver screen.
Yeah, it's a big pain in the neck, to be honest.
And is it spreading, or is it diminishing, or what's happening to silver screens?
France, they've banned them. By 2017, you can't. You know, all silver screens have to be replaced. Now, whether that law sticks, who knows? But
and in Japan, by the way, they've just announced a survey that I think 70% of the exhibitors that control 70% of the cinemas are going to go all digital by next year.
Yeah, Japan is one of the last remaining countries to make that kind of announcement. You know, there's a couple Latin American countries, but Japan, one would think, given that it's the home of NEC, given it's where some of the technology, including DLP, is manufactured, that it would have thought, oh, we'll go digital as soon as possible. They are one of the last to talk about it.
So North America is essentially digital, or how far along is
it? It's, I would say, between 60 and 75%, somewhere in that range. It's close. It's definitely close. By 2014, I would not be shocked if you hear a 100% figure.
If there's like the last of the commercial, you know, there will always be some art house or some independent thing or whatever, but for the big commercial chains, they'll be all digital.
Yes.
And what does that mean for the viewers? Better print, better image?
Better
typically?
Image, better prints. There'll sometimes be key issues where the film can't play or the projector breaks down. And unlike a film projector where you could just kind of jerry-rig it, sometimes you can't do that with a digital projector. You know, it's kind of like when your computer breaks down, it breaks down. However, when the K key on your manual typewriter breaks, you might be able to, fudge it a bit.
And in the U.S., are silver screens, or a.k.a. aluminum screens, are they spreading or are they diminishing? What's happening to them
here? I don't know. That's a good question. I think that people, you know, Real D continues to get more and more customers. So I would say they're spreading.
Real D is spreading. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh. All right. Well, thanks for bringing in those extra details, CJ.
Yes. And if you want to write to us, again, the email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Alternatively, you could give us a call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. That information can be found on our website, where you can also find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. Our website is showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways that you can follow us. We have a Twitter account, and our Twitter username is ShowbizSandbox. Our Facebook page is ShowbizSandbox. Our website is ShowbizSandbox.com. And on our website, you'll find ways to subscribe to the show, either in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or on Stitcher. And really, we encourage you to subscribe, whether it's through email notification or rate and review the show on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or any one of these podcast aggregators. We really appreciate it, and it does help us out. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website where you can find some of his writing. Do you want to tell us where it is, Michael?
Shockingly, it's called michaelgiltz.com.
Some of my writing can be found at celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.